and welcome to Restoring the Soul, a podcast dedicated to helping you close the gap between what you believe and what you actually experience. I'm your producer, Brian Beatty. Thanks for listening. On this edition of Restoring the Soul, Michael welcomes Mako and Heijin Shim Fujimura. Today, they'll discuss a number of topics ranging from trauma, 9/11, kintsugi, the COVID-19 pandemic, and human trafficking. Mako is a leading contemporary artist whose process-driven, refractive, slow art has been described by David Brooks of the New York Times as a small rebellion against the quickening of time. He's also an arts advocate, writer, and speaker who's recognized worldwide as a cultural influencer. Married to Mako, Heijin is an international attorney and CEO of Embers International, whose mission is to protect, restore, and empower victims of injustice with a goal to end intergenerational exploitation and prevent human trafficking. She also serves as the president of Kintsugi Academy. Her life mission is to bring light into the darkness and help others to be remade in order for them to recover. We're going to pick up the discussion with Heijin talking about how her life journey reflects Kintsugi.
My life journey has been one that reflects, you know, what we call Kintsugi, and then we can introduce Kintsugi a little bit more later. But looking back, whenever there was a major season ahead of me, that's when I experienced a certain kind of trauma from which God, by His grace, really restored me through making me into someone that is a better version of myself. So through trauma, you know, I gained this deep understanding of compassion and deeper understanding of justice and self-discovery. And through that journey, you know, I have become a lawyer and a justice advocate. And through that journey, I realized that, you know, whenever there is a new season, I needed to become I need to be made once again. And through that journey, I was able to see the people's lives that are also broken, and also see a hope and possibility of being made into new. So, you know, I started my legal career about 17 years ago, and I'm a litigator and business law practitioner. I have my own law firm. And even through that training, I saw a lot of brokenness in the legal industry. So from then on, you know, I was able to start my own law firm that has created a very redeemed law firm culture, very different kind of legal team that actually get to love their work.
Wow. there are people going, wow, lawyers love their work and a different culture.
Yes. And I'm one of them. I love my work. And that's because we see our legal career as something that is of making, that we have to be extremely creative. We have to be extremely compassionate and extremely have a depth of understanding of, you know, what's going on with our clients and the world and so forth. So through that, you know, I got to really serve a lot of my clients, but also by being an entrepreneur, I got to have my own schedule, and which allowed me to start this organization called Embers International. And Embers International is a anti-trafficking, anti-slavery organization that protects, restores, and empowers people who are victims of injustice. And right now we focus on the survivors of trafficking in India, and also children who are at risk of trafficking in the slums in the red light district, and also their mothers who are still oppressed from generational exploitation. And for them, what we had to imagine is that there are although, you know, suffering from just incredible violence right now, that there is a hope for this kintsugi beauty, that their scars are going to be filled with gold and blood of Christ and the sweats of God's people showing up at their door, and them becoming someone who's more beautiful and valuable. When the scars are not hidden, but accentuated, but those scars will become beautiful. So that's the story of restoration through this kintsugi journey, which I, you know, understood before even I met Mako. And after we met, I mean, that idea and the work of kintsugi for restoration became even more clearer. But Embers International uses the metaphor kintsugi because we have to be able to see the victims, not as just victims, but as people who are on their journey of restoration.
And I'll once again allow you guys to navigate who shares, but I remember Mako hearing a talk from you that with the kintsugi art form, which I hope you unpack, that the broken pottery was not seen as broken, but as something that was in and of itself beautiful. So that metaphor for Embers International is really profound because, yes, there's damage done through trauma, but there's something fundamental in the soul that remains intact, the image of God. So that's so powerful.
It is. Kintsugi is a Japanese term. Kin is gold and tsugi means to mend. And it flows out of this venerable tradition of tea ceremony of Senno Rikyu in particular, who in 16th century Japan, during a feudal war time, established this path of peacemaking through the very heightened ritual of tea, serving tea to the very powerful. And out of that aesthetic came out this notion that something that has been broken, something that is rusting away or worn thin, are more beautiful because they are have gone through this journey. And so when the tea ware inevitably breaks in a earthquake-prone Japan, the family of tea masters will often keep the fragments for several generations before they give it to a Japan lacquer master. And Japan lacquer is made from urushi, which is from poison sumac. It's a notoriously difficult craft to learn. This mastery leads into mending these broken pieces, but instead of, let's say super gluing it back together to make it look like nothing was ever damaged, Japan lacquer master instead mends in a way that heightens the fractures and sprinkles gold or paints gold, pouring it into the fractures, and sometimes even going further to embellish and add on pieces as if to say that the fragments, which are beautiful in themselves, can be amplified into a new creation. And the kintsugi teaware is more valuable than the original, recognizing that this bowl was created twice. It's such a beautiful metaphor, and I have a chapter in my new book, Art and Faith, The Theology of Making, that just came out this year on kintsugi, and how theologically it is so powerful, and it's a perfect way to understand Jesus's post-resurrection appearance. And this book is all about this theology that leads into new creation. As an artist, reading the Bible as a book of making, and the post-appearance of Jesus' post-resurrection journey indicates that Jesus chose to be human after all that he's gone through. He could have appeared as anything, and yet he chose to be human. And not only he chose to be human, but he chose to be a wounded human. His nail marks us with him, as he shows Thomas. And that shows that even to God, this reality of what Japanese tradition of Kintsugi shows is exactly the way new creation works. So that leads to, for me to consider and for us to consider, if Jesus, to Jesus, humanity, being human, is so important that that's the emanation that he chose, but also that his wounds, through his wounds we are healed, and through his wounds this new creation flows out of, then our journey of, you know, going through dark times and fragmentation ourselves, being pulverized, that's just as important to God. We may not see it that way, going through trauma. You know, I have my share of darkness going through 9/11 and the subsequent trauma that affected my life deeply. But those are ways that I can enter into healing and new creation. And that, you know, metaphor is very powerful for me as I think about a marriage, I think about my art, think about my life.
Yeah, the Kintsugi bowl that we have, and I first discovered Kintsugi through you a couple of years back, it's just beautiful to look at, and I can gaze upon it like one might gaze upon a more traditional religious icon or a cross. And I just want to say, for any listeners, if you've not seen Kintsugi, you can certainly Google it, but it can sound like this sentimental idea, like, well, isn't that nice? The broken pieces get filled in with gold. But it really is quite stunning how I can always imagine the original piece, like, oh, that's nice. But to see the cracks filled in, the texture, almost spider-like veins, and how it goes outward, it's just really remarkable. And I do consider it a kind of icon that mediates the heart of God. Will you talk a little bit about how, and either or both of you, about how making, whether making an organization and bringing to life the vision of restoring others, or Mako, for you as an actual visual artist and painter, how making contributed to healing trauma?
Yeah, art has a way of capturing honest, vulnerable reality of being human, and true art doesn't shy away from what is difficult or dark. And sometimes it can get caught up in that negative cycle, or it might become only capturing the darkness. And I have tried as an artist to understand my own art as a way to bring hope and light through darkness. And so even after 9/11, my exhibit coming up in New York at Highline 9 Gallery is called Remembrance. And there's a dash between re and remembrance as we think about Kintsugi, you know, thinking back on 9/11, thinking back on Columbine High School massacre, and thinking back on 3/11, tsunami, and ongoing nuclear meltdown. That is something that we have to reconnect, remember. And my art has always been part of that journey of looking at something ground zero in a most honest way, but then creating something out of that, through or beyond that. And so my exhibit, my art being exhibited is going to be an emblem of that journey. When I met Hejin and when we began to journey together, and I realized, and I walk into her law office, I'm astonished because the office, the staff, her team has this incredible dynamic, beautiful, and joyous presence. Her office does not look like a lawyer's office, but it is partly because she's now married to me. It is like a gallery. There's a lot of art and welded, and you know you walk in and you hear laughter, you hear people working hard, but it is something that brings, and on the walls, pictures of children in India that they have dedicated themselves as a law office to volunteer themselves to help those who need their help, legal counsel and so forth. And to me, that, you know, is a reality of how, you know, it's not just art, right? It's all of our endeavors, all of our, what we can do in terms of bringing light into the darkness. And so I'm so honored to, you know, learn more about that and to be part of Embers International.
Embers International as an organization, of course, its mission is to restore people. So, you know, that's really kind of obvious. That's what we do and what we try to accomplish. But also at the same time, if any of nonprofit leaders are listening to this podcast, yeah, I want them to know that each one of you are a maker.
Yeah.
Because every day you're making this organization possible. You're making programs. You're making systems, and you're making a better team. Every single day, you are a maker. And when we do that, what happens, I realize, is that we become more and more of a fully human that God intended us to be. And through that process, there is a restoration that happens to the makers, mm-hmm, ourselves, mm-hmm, because we become more of a full human that reflects God. And you know, when I started this, co-founded Embers International in 2016, and then we really started our operation in 2018, thinking about then and thinking about today, and, you know, I have been going through this journey of making through this organization and of this organization, that I am a better version of myself today than then. I have a more compassion and more knowledge and more understanding of the clients that we serve now and then. And same thing with being a lawyer too. You know, I tell my lawyers that you are a maker, and you make a case for your clients, that you make an argument and strategy to represent and advocate for on behalf of our client. And as we do that, we become not only a better lawyer, but also a better person, more restored person that can embrace trauma and be healed through it and help other people be healed. So I think, yes, making and restoration has this direct connection. If we understand it and not only understand, but be aware of it every single day, that what we do has a deeper meaning, and our restoration can be even more powerful.
That is powerful. And it goes back to something you said, Hejin, at the beginning, where you said that as you were healing from trauma, you were being remade. And it was the being remade that then gave you a vision and allowed you to step into helping to remake others. And Mako, in your previous writings, Culture Care and In Silence, you talk about this word generativity. And I think we don't use that word a lot, and it's often misunderstood, but what you're both talking about, you don't have to be a world famous visual artist or to take an art class to be a maker, we're all bringing that sense of there's something inside of us that we're generating, and our wounding and our trauma wants to shut that down. It's like it wants to put a lid on it. So I love this connection between making, not as something in and of itself, although that's valuable, but as a healing, restorative, really essential part of being human.
Yeah, and we think of making as making something new or making something that's innovative and never existed before. But really what making is on this side of eternity is always dealing with the fractures that has happened before. And out of that trauma and fracture, we begin to see something new. And the great example of this is you look at all of the art and literature that has come out directly out of front lines of wars. You have C.S. Lewis, you have, you know, J.R.R. Tolkien, you have J.D. Salinger, you have Hemingway, you have Shakespeare, you know, creating his theater, Globe Theater, outside of London because of the Black Plague, right? And you have Frangelico painting during the height of Black Plague and ushering in basically the Renaissance. All these people were faced with enormous challenges and darkness of their own time, and they chose to create in response to that. And so, you know, I think of a time as a very significant moment in reality of faith, you know, faith, not only facing the darkness, but acknowledging that it is through the fragmentation and fractures and difficulties that oftentimes something enduring will come out. And I talk about generativity, and that word has been always been important to me. My father was a renowned pure scientist, researcher, Bell Labs, and I was born in Boston because he was doing his work on generative grammar with Noam Chomsky. And so I grew up with that term. And there, as you noted, there are several definitions of this. But I always connected to Genesis. You know, I always say generativity is creating Genesis moments, which means no matter what happened yesterday or, you know, months before or 10 years ago, 20 years ago, this is a Genesis moment right now. And everyone has an opportunity to reframe their past and to create the future. And to me as an artist, the best way to do that is to be present, fully present in the moment, to be able to observe what is in front of me as a visual artist. But for any kind of making, the Embers International and Sherman Associates lawyers have to pay attention to the person and organizations that they're helping, be present in that sense. And so, we are in that business of, walking into very traumatized and fragmented realities. And we have the opportunity to stay present in that, until we see beauty in the fragments.
Where do either of you see a proliferation of beauty and making in the midst of the pandemic? And there's part of me that wants to say, you know, now that we're out of the pandemic, but we all know that, especially in the part of the country you're in, that we're not out of it. So it seems like things have been stagnated, and yet I see pockets of light and hope and creativity.
I think one thing that I found is that there's a new appreciation for the frontline workers, yeah. Right, during this yes. pandemic, that yes. They have received now the spotlight because we recognize, which we didn't before, how important they are, you know, whether you are, you know, frontline or at the hospitals or making deliveries to different homes. I mean, there's certain shift that happened during the pandemic that we're still kind of processing. But, you know, we see this world where now we have a common language that, you know, Marco explains that can, I think, translate into if we were to do it right and if we were to be patient about this global pandemic as we are still kind of going through it, that the beauty of having this common language globally mm-hmm. and having the common understanding of what trauma is and how we can come out of it all together. And to do that, we actually need one another globally, mm-hmm. right? I mean, this is virus. So just because we have the vaccine and we are vaccinated doesn't mean that we are safe. Mm-hmm. We need everyone in the world to be protected. So I think the sense of oneness, the unity that is for good, that we need to look after one another, and me protecting myself and just being selfish is really not going to help you mm-hmm. with that mm-hmm. purpose. So I think that's something that I have seen. What about you, Malcolm?
Malcolm Gladwell, very early on in the pandemic, noticed several things that paradigm shifts that are happening in culture, and he calls it the weak link society versus strong link society. And he identified that all of a sudden, you know, before the pandemic, we were a strong link society, which means like the people on top gets all the decisions and influence. So strong wins basically because they dominate the conversation. And you know, quickly the pandemic has turned us into weak links society, which means there are many people, essential workers, who we never paid attention to before, Amazon deliverers and, you know, nurses and teachers that literally stood on the front lines as the most important part of society moving forward. And he compares this to basketball versus soccer. In basketball, if you have one very, you know, incredible player, you know, you can do okay. You can still win the game. But in soccer, if you have one weak player, the other team can exploit that and you're not going to win too many games. And so given that we have shifted into weak links society, and I think the reality now is to look at moving forward, even post-pandemic, so-called, quote-unquote, you know, will that remain to be a possibility? And I think that is where generativity can come in. When we realize that there's not a single person on this earth today that has not been directly impacted by COVID virus in some way. I mean, that's a remarkable statement to make, one that we probably couldn't have named before. We didn't have a situation in which all of us shared, you know, my experience of being a ground zero resident in 9/11 in New York City. You know, that's not everybody's experience. My trauma, what we went through as ground zero residents and raising my children there, is relevant to that particular area and can be, you know, applied. But today it's as if everybody was in that ground zero zone, faced with same trauma, same issues of, you know, what happens after with post-trauma issues. And so I call that this shared curse that can be a common grace kind of a experience where because we can identify with each other, you know, somebody in Assam, India, is facing the same kind of trauma that I am going through, the same kind of fear, same kind of anxiety. Even worse, because they're more exposed to the vulnerabilities. But, you know, we can be aware of that. And as Embers International has done, they raised $80,000 to create an oxygen tank plant in Assam, India. And to me, that was just the most beautiful sign of generativity. Because this oxygen tank plant in a rural hospital will mean that this area, which is often cited as kind of a nexus of human trafficking, lawyers associated with Embers, like IJM, International Justice Missions, and others, can have at least create a safe space for these immigrant workers to find safety. And so my, you know, issues, you know, that I have to deal with in Princeton, New Jersey, is directly connected with that person who is, you know, journeying perhaps from China into India. I don't know, but, you know, and you can actually buy the tea, Assam tea, which is known for its remarkable flavor, you know, English tea developed in that region. And so while we drink this tea, we can be thinking directly about the impact of various decisions that we can make today to help that person who is picking tea in Assam.
Yeah, that is so beautiful. Hey, Jen, will you talk about the website and how people can learn more about Embers International?
Sure. Thank you for that question. If you go to embersinternational.org, it's E-M-B-E-R-S, you'll be able to see, you know, what our organization is all about, our programs, and how you can support the work and participate. Embers International, is ultimate goal is to prevent trafficking. And prevention work is really hard. And it's rarely emphasized because it's so hard to showcase the measurable outcome. Because how do you showcase something that didn't happen, right? Hmm. However, the work that we do, the protection, restoration, and empowerment, and the specific program that we have that targets the two generations living in the red light area right now is going to ultimately lead to that prevention. So right now, our team in India is located in Turbe Red Light District in Mumbai, India. And we have this beautiful children's center called Sahasi Embers. Sahasi in Hindi means courageous. So we have a courageous little flames that are receiving services. And also we have courageous little flames are serving our children and the woman there. So we have this very important community hub, and that offers daycare to the children who are born into brothels and living in the red light area. We provide educational center and counseling, legal aid clinic, which is the only free legal service for the entire Dubai red light area. Then we collaborate with the Indian government and vocational training. The people that we serve through the Sahasi Embers Center is just really remarkable, resilient people, but they have suffered through generational exploitation. So if you can imagine a woman who are trafficked into the brothel and trapped in that slavery, you know, I've gone into the brothels as an undercover, so I've seen the condition of these places where the women are being abused every day. If you are a minor, then you are tucking to the back in a locked door with no windows for years until you are major or you look like a major and your will is broken because of the daily beating and exploitation so that you don't run away because you are just so broken. And then finally you're let out and you look like you are there voluntarily, but they are really not. And now the condition that they live in is terrible. It's filthy. But inevitably what happens is that they get pregnant and they give birth to a child. And if you can imagine where this child will grow up, this child doesn't have her own bed or her own room or playroom or any sanitary place that she can be placed. So where she grows up, if you can imagine with me, is under the mother's bed. And this is very bad that mother gets abused every night. And this little child will experience everything that mother experienced under the bed. And if you can also imagine this little infant child under the mother's bed at night, this child will cry because the child is longing for the mother, hungry, wakes up at night. You know, all of you parents outside can empathize with, you know, what will happen to this child at night. So this child will be force-fed alcohol and drug as an infant so that she will keep quiet at night and not disturb the business in the brothels. So that's the life of these children that we serve. And at a certain age, they'll become either sex slave or traffickers or pimps, if you're a boy. And that's the kind of destiny that is predetermined for them. And unless there's an intervention that empowers the child as well as the mother, there's no hope for them to leave that red light area. So we have this two-generational approach where we are now sending the children who are born into brothels to private school so they can get the best education they can get. They can learn what human dignity and respect and love and care is through our team at South Embers at that center. And now we're planning on empowering their mothers. This is going to be a long journey. And this, as you can imagine, kind of work is very difficult. It's very complicated. You know, we deal with our own traumas. You know, I remember, you know, me dealing with my own traumas, and I thought that was complicated. But the trauma that our clients go through is just a lot deeper and more complicated, especially because some of them, and most of them, a lot of them have experienced this for generationally. Yeah. So can we step in and stop this intergenerational evil so that these children have a hope for the future? So, you know, that's the message that Embers is giving to the world, that yes, there is still hope. Because we understand the kintsugi life that we have. And we know that these children can also experience that kintsugi life.
You just had a person come out of that and become a lawyer, right?
So one of our, so we also have a legacy education program, which is educating the survivor of trafficking as well as at-risk youth for higher education. So we have a survivor that was rescued by our partner organization in India, and we were able to help this survivor with a higher education. She wanted to study law, and so she just completed the law school and became a lawyer.
That is incredible. In the midst of a horrifying and dehumanizing existence. You know, when we hear about Jesus going after the one and leaving behind the 99, we often think of that almost exclusively in terms of evangelism and, you know, go to heaven instead of hell. But Jesus goes after the one to take them out of that horror, whether they become a believer or not. There's light there in that darkness. And I love how you talk about the kintsugi life, because everybody can relate to that and automatically understands that. Is there anything being done with Embers International with the prevention side? I've done a lot of work and speaking around the demand side, and that seems like such a deep, deep cultural issue that seems like it's a rock so big you can't move it.
So education is a key. Making the public aware of the problem. And you know, making sure that, you know, we don't do rescue work, but our partner organizations do, and making sure that the public understands that there is no impunity for this type of crime is also very important. But also what's really important is empowering the community. So we have our South Embers team will go out to the community into the red light area every single day to do community outreach. And what they do is they look for people who are in need. So just recently, we found two children, ages 6 and 8, both girls, and their dying mother on the street because they were basically abandoned by their family. So So they were on the street just about a couple months ago during the pandemic, and mother was really sick. So our South Amherst team was able to bring them to South Amherst Center and take care of the children and then send the mother to the hospital. 4 days later, the mother passed away from TB. Now these two children are orphaned. But for our team's community outreach and being in the community and being the eyes of the community for these children would have been just trafficked and sold into the brothels. And, you know, we are very assured of it because that happens all the time. So the prevention work has to happen not only through education and the rescue work and the legal avenues, but also by empowering the community to be the watchdog for other people, to be there to embrace these kind of children from the street. And we were able to place them in a government shelter afterwards so that they can have a long-term home. The traffickers, these criminals, what they do is they prey on the vulnerability of the people. And they are not by nature courageous people at all. So when communities come together and when we look at these children who are the least regarded in the society, who are born into the brothel, when we come together and be their protector, their family, their advocates, the criminals cannot really touch them. They don't have the courage to do it. But we need to empower the community to do so in the local areas.
So I'm hearing a theme between even what you did with your law firm, where you're very intentional about creating a certain kind of culture, to how your organization is going in and going deep into the culture, trying to affect it at a systemic level, as opposed to just going there and giving some handouts or doing some kind of dramatic intervention and then leaving. And that's really neat. So as I hear both of you talk about Kintsugi, it's just such a kingdom of God reality. The Malcolm Gladwell idea of the weak links, that it's the weak links of those trafficking victims in India that they're allowing the light to shine through, and people are showing up and making in that place. And isn't that the truth, that the kingdom of God shines most intensely in the darkness, but we have to show up and we have to risk and to make? Isn't it true that there really is a risk in making? I mean, whether you're painting a canvas or starting an organization or trying to have a baby.
Yes, totally. And that's one thing that I treasure about journeying together, is that years and years of my discipline of making, which is risk taking and being entrepreneur and creating something that didn't exist before, right? And every time I face a canvas, I am invoking new creation, right? This is a Genesis moment. I'm trained to trust my intuition to carry me into the unknown. And so the mystery of creativity and making has a powerful way of inviting the world into hope. And because without hope, you can't create, right? Without hope of, you know, me painting something and it somebody is going to see that. Why paint it, right? Or you can also paint in a way that is strictly for the audience of one, you know, for God, for you to offer that to God. And even that requires hope and faith, right? So now that mechanism, that intuitive mechanism that I've built up over the years, apply to what's happening in India, apply to embers, apply to creating imagination, sanctified imagination to work toward restoration and healing, right? Rather than co-opting it, let's say, for selfish purposes. That, you know, because of what I do as an artist, and I am invoking the new through my work, that space, that gallery space, the studio space here, becomes an ideal way to communicate what is happening to the least of these, to the weaklings, and to raise them up to become the powerful influencers that we believe that they can become, and they already are. That, you know, that makes me realize that, again, going back to Kintsugi, this idea of a Kintsugi master beholding the fragments and not even trying to fix it, right? They're just looking at it and looking at it until the fragments become beautiful and complete in itself. And then the work begins to create something new out of that experience. But the Kintsugi master doesn't start until he or she can see the landscape in the fragments. He or she can see the river, a golden river. And that to me is a way that we can move into hopefully post-pandemic time and keep the value of weakling society, that we can be connect the dismembered, fragmented way in the art culture certainly has experienced, but going forward with trauma, with you know, this deep rift that we experience in the world, those are ways that imagination can create into the new. And so when I hear stories of children being rescued and names of these particular children who go through Sahasi Embers and it's becoming nurses and lawyers and I just see that story as so much more beautiful than anything that I can create. And yet I'm privileged that my work can connect with that and be part of that journey, for them, for me, for us, but also as we share that with the world, this is something that everybody can participate in.
Isn't my husband so wonderful and beautiful? And I can listen to him all day long.
Me too. I've always, Mako, your voice has always been so soothing. And from a trauma perspective, and I just spent 4 hours today doing an intensive with people with trauma. There's something that's just so grounding, and your words are beautiful, just like your paintings. But what strikes me in what you said is that nothing would exist today without imagination. And Heijin, without somebody, you and your colleagues saying, "Okay, here's this horror in Mumbai, but let's imagine what could be done." And then to think about, just like Mako, you're generating beauty in paintings that you're, through your organization, Heijin, generating this healing. And then to hear the stories of others who would otherwise just go by the wayside, they're becoming generative. And I think about that baby under the mother's bed all night, that as that child grows, they have no capacity for imagination unless someone else imagines for them a different life. And so it's really impossible to heal from trauma without saying things could be different. There is another way, another reality in which to live. So finally, I heard you talk about resurrecting the Kintsugi Academy. I want to have you share with people how they can learn more about that. And then I've got to come back to tea, because at the Culture Care Conference, you allowed myself to go to a high tea ceremony with Kiko. And so what's the tea? Can people buy that at the Embers International site, or can they sign up for it?
Well, maybe we'll start creating it with Assam, with people there. But Kintsugi Academy is relaunching, and we're so excited to have the Kintsugi Master from Japan come on 9/11 in New York City to relaunch this effort to bring this conversational healing and practice of healing that anybody can do, anybody can learn to do, but we need certified trainers. So we're going to be certifying these people that we selected and journeying with them. And along with them is a friend, Kurt Thompson, Dr. Thompson, who is a psychiatrist, and he will talk about healing and trauma. Shan Ray Furch, who's a National Book Award winning poet and writer, who is also a professor of forgiveness at Gonzaga University. And several others will join us and create resources for these. And I could not have done this exhibit without Ajahn's help. And actually, her entire team has been my team. And they're organizing, you know, exhibit these gatherings, you know, limited as they may be today. We're going to be creating resources so that others can take advantage of it in remote sessions.
Our website is being created right now, so it's not available just yet, but it's going to be www.culturalcarecreative.com, and you will find more resources on that about Kintsugi Academy. And ultimately, with the certified instructors that we're going to train, we want to be able to raise up what we call Kintsugi peacemakers. Mm-hmm. And these are the people that are going to come with us to conflict zones and present Kintsugi to places like Palestine, Israel, India, Pakistan, Japan, Korea, UK, Ireland, to show that, yes, peacemaking is possible. Restoration is possible. Forgiveness is possible. Healing and restoration is possible in these deeply, deeply rooted trauma areas. Just to follow Marco's talk about the risk-taking and the hope that we have, I think ultimately risk-taking can lead to restoration or making only if it's motivated by love. So when you take a risk, you take a risk because it's really worth it. And when we find it, I mean, the only reason why I think that we find it's worth taking that risk is because we have a little bit of love towards it. You know, I took a risk of starting my own law firm because I love practicing law. You know, it's very broken. You know, law is imperfect and it's far from it, far from perfection. But I love law. And because I know God is the lawgiver, and the true meaning of law when it was given to us from the very beginning of this world, I co-created Embers International because I love these clients who are awaiting restoration. And so I think all of that is to say that, you know, what we do through Kintsugi Academy and Marco's making and my work as a lawyer and nonprofit leader is that is really motivated by love. And I think Kintsugi represents that love, because without love for this broken vessel, we wouldn't actually mend it into new.
Yeah, and as Vincent van Gogh said, the greatest work of art is to love people.
So we've wrapped up another episode of Restoring the Soul. We want you to know that Restoring the Soul is so much more than a podcast. In fact, the heart of what we have done for nearly 20 years is intensive counseling. When you can't wait months or years to get out of the rut you're in, our intensive counseling programs in Colorado allow you to experience deep change in half-day blocks over 2 weeks. To learn more, visit RestoringTheSoul.com. That's RestoringTheSoul.com.
You already know we live in a pornified world, but most of us are at a loss for how to navigate this sea of temptation. It's either ceaseless striving on the one hand or giving in to brokenness on the other. But doesn't the gospel offer us another way? The truth is that our sexual struggles are not actually about sex, but about a misdirected, God-given longing for deep connection. Dig deeper in my book, Surfing for God, Discovering the Divine Desire Beneath Sexual Struggle.